This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hey folks, it's the evening edition. Uma and Ezra here, and of course today is World Refugee Day. And here in Malaysia, we're faced with the continuous influx of displaced individuals seeking refuge in our country. And in spite of that, we have yet to sign the only global legal instrument dealing with the status and rights of refugees. That's the 1951 Refugee Convention and its 1967 Protocol.
Today, we're joined by Deepa Nambiar, Director of Asylum Access Malaysia, an international organization that works on protecting refugees through legal aid and policy advocacy, and Daniel Lowe, Special Officer of Human Rights at Senator Paul Lowe at the Prime Minister's Office. Guys, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Now, just to kick things off, can you give folks listening in an idea of what both of you do respectively? Daniel, maybe we can start with you.
Well, I'm Senator Dato' Paul's Special Officer on Human Rights. Effectively, I advise him on issues of human rights. And it's always, of course, nice to be listened to by your boss when you give them advice. I attend meetings. There are a variety of meetings which come into relevance to human rights, human trafficking, migrant workers, alternatives to detention. There's a whole host of human rights issues which we deal with.
And Deepa, can you tell us a little bit more about your role at Asylum Access Malaysia?
So I'm the director of Asylum Access. And Asylum Access is a refugee rights organization. And simply put, we help refugees access their rights in Malaysia. That's obviously a bit tricky in a country that doesn't actually have any laws that can be enforced. But what we do is we work very closely with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the UNHCR. Most refugees come to Malaysia and have to be processed through the UN, and so we are refugee lawyers. We help them get refugee status to the UN. And with that status, they are able to access a whole slew of other rights.
How long have you guys been around?
We're quite new. We registered about a year and a half ago, but as an international organization, we have been around for about 10 years.
All right. So what inspired a chapter in Malaysia then? Because we've been getting refugees for ages.
Yeah.
So why just about a year and a half ago?
We were quite small at first. So our first offices were in Thailand and Ecuador, and they went through a phase where they wanted to expand to a few different countries. And they were looking at Malaysia as one of the potential countries. And I think what the reason why we ended up expanding here is, first of all, really high numbers of refugees compared to other countries in the region. And the fact that there is some sort of a framework that we can work with. There's an office, there's a UN office here that's a really huge office. It's over 100 staff. And they process a lot of refugees every year. And so it made sense for us to come in at this point, try to get refugees access to some rights through the UN process, and at the same time see how we can possibly influence the larger law and policy framework in Malaysia.
And Daniel, I guess you're the closest person we have in the room that has, access to Putrajaya. And how, I guess, the government views this current situation. Maybe you could give folks a primer or 101 as to what Malaysia's attitude is towards this situation.
Well, I think what Deepa said is, in terms of refugees, we don't have a specific law. There's no legal recognition for refugees. However, there's a lot of actually administrative practical recognition which they do have. For a start, the UNHCR is recognized by the Malaysian government and has its office set up here. The chief of UNHCR actually does present his credentials to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So there is some administrative recognition of that. But as Deepa said correctly, the legal position is that persons who are not citizens, foreign individuals in Malaysia, must have a visa to be a documented person or a person here. If they're not, then they are subject to immigration laws, arrest and detention and deportation. There are some administrative laws, rules which are in place to minimize that, but that's what they are. So that's really the framework in the gist of it.
Right. So I'm going to ask you both a very difficult question. I want you to respond to this. But in my opinion, at least, the perception is that not all refugees are created equal, that some refugees are more equal than others. And that's what it feels like, at least with the common rhetoric, at least with that coming out of politicians, there always seems to be a little more attention paid to whatever's hot at the moment, and then we forget. So how do we, in my thinking, a law is absolutely crucial to make sure everyone has the same access, right? So it's not just upon the whims and fancies of some speech somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, I think definitely the whole principle of rule of law is that everybody is equal under the law. No one escapes. That's the ideal. And if we look over the history of Malaysia's experience with refugees, with the administrative framework we have, there have been different treatments. There have been some very, very positive treatments. We've recognized Achenese, Filipinos, those up in Sabah. We've also had, of course, the Indo-Chinese, the Vietnamese refugees. So that was a large number of people. It was a different era. That was the Cold War era. There were different political dynamics that were involved there. Of course, our Prime Minister made the announcement about the Syrian refugees. So, and also, of course, there was the agreement which fell apart, but that arrangement between Australia and Malaysia.
That's right.
There. So, is there different treatment? I think there are things do change from time to time. Would a law help? I think that would possibly help too. Yes, certainly.
How does it apply in real life with the work that you, the NGO work that you do? Mm-hmm. What do you see and what are the kind of problems you come across with, I guess, the different treatments between, say, Syrian refugees who now have special attention as opposed to Palestinian refugees who've been coming here for so long, they're so easily forgotten. Yeah. As just being, oh, look, it's another one, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's two different things. One is the treatment in terms of their recognition as refugees under the UNHCR process. And in that process, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, they're different levels, different ways to process them, of course, based on their international protection needs. So someone from Syria, for example, would probably go through a simpler process, be recognized easier just because it's more convenient to do that. And it's easier to do that. Well, someone else from, say, a country, you know, like Iran or Pakistan, it might be a little bit more complex because their claims are complex. But that's one thing, and that's a fair process, I would say. But when it comes to the government's response and the different treatments there, I think that is a huge problem for NGOs working in this space. Obviously, you know that there's 150,000 registered refugees in Malaysia that are already sort of languishing here, really, with very limited access to rights. And then there's an announcement that the government hopes to bring in 3,000 Syrian refugees over the next 3 years. We can speculate as to why. It does seem like they're responding to an urgent crisis. It's a very popular issue right now. Our Prime Minister made an announcement in the UN, so it was, you know, widely applauded, and all's well and good. And it's certainly better than not taking the 3,000, I would say. But we also need to look at the situation on the ground. Obviously, it's really problematic to have 150,000 refugees in Malaysia that don't have any access to these rights, but then bring in 3,000 refugees and give them a whole set of different rights.
I think one thing that's interesting also is that when we look at different groups, at different ethnic groups, refugees from different ethnic backgrounds, different nationalities, sometimes the treatment is also a consequence, perhaps, of the Malaysian general populace response. So, I mean, what was very interesting, normally we don't have a very positive response to boat people in Malaysia, whether it be government or the general populace. But when we had the last Andaman Sea boat arrivals that, you know, were taken care of at the Blantyre Immigration Centre, I think it was about over 1,000 individuals. Mm-hmm. And there was an outpouring of support for them, for the Malaysian government to go and do search and sea rescue, and that also coincided with the amendments of the Anti-Trafficking Persons Act, and you saw both opposition and backbenchers all unanimously supporting their rescue. So there is also that dynamic that plays a critical role.
Folks, more about Malaysia's standpoint when it comes to refugees in Malaysia. It's the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments, BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to the evening edition. You're with Uma and Ezra, and it's World Refugee Day. And in the studio with us is Deepa Nambiar, Director of Asylum Access Malaysia. That's an international organization that works on protecting refugees through legal aid and policy advocacy. And Daniel Lowe, Special Officer of Human Rights to Senator Paul Lau at the Prime Minister's Office. And we're speaking about the legal issues surrounding refugees in the country. Now, Daniel, is there a particular reason as to why specific legal instruments haven't been applied in the time that we've been dealing with this situation? I mean, are there certain obstacles?
You're talking about the Refugee Convention?
That's right.
Why haven't we signed?
Well, generally the view is that the Malaysian government isn't quick to sign refugee conventions. Now, there are protagonists and antagonists, both sides of that argument. I think what is important, and even this will be said by those on who are in favor of supporting refugees, is that it is just an instrument. And there will be lots more that we need to do in terms of implementing any laws, any regulations, and we also have to domesticate that convention, meaning we can sign, but we still have to change our laws for it to take effect locally in Malaysia. So,
but that would be a symbolic gesture.
Yeah,
surely.
Exactly. So therefore, signing onto the convention would be symbolic. It is a big symbol, it will be one which Malaysian government can demonstrate its leadership regionally and internationally as well.
And I guess the reason is because, you know, in the past 5 or 10 years, and maybe you could appreciate as to why we haven't gotten around to this, but, you know, we have multiple generations of kids from different countries, you know, and then they've had no access to education and all sorts of long-term systemic problems that trickle on to the Malaysian community at large. And I guess I'm sure somebody within the halls of Putrajaya is saying, well, in the long run, we just have to deal with this situation anyway.
I think,
well,
that person's, yeah, Daniel. Right?
The meeting starts now, right? Well, if I put some context, that actually helps us with understanding. Well, so if it was only five odd years, maybe it's something which is rather new, and maybe we could understand why we haven't signed on to it. But if we understand how the Refugee Convention actually came about. I mean, it's basically an outcome of World War and movement of displaced persons. It was a horrendous movement of, you know, Europeans all over the place. That really was what was the catalyst for the convention. Now, I'm not saying in any way that we need a third World War or anything like that for us to sign. But I mean, really, that's how significant that instrument was and the context of how it came about. And what should we do in Malaysia? I think we really do have to tackle this very holistically. Yeah, and we can't do it in dribs and drabs. Definitely, I don't think there'll be anybody who disagrees with that. Now, one of the reasons why I think there's some reticence to sign is that what we call pull factor. There is always a concern, and this is those who are, government has to think for these sectors as well and these issues as well. Will it create a pull for more refugees to come to Malaysia? More than necessary, more than intended, more than maybe even entitled. In other words, are there individuals who are not really entitled to refugee status and come claim that? Because they will be here pending the refugee status determination conducted by either UNHCR or the government, depending how that system works out. So that is one of the big considerations that government has to make.
If we could just add on that, I mean, this conversation about whether we should sign the Refugee Convention or not is a really interesting one. I mean, certainly I started this firmly believing the government should sign the convention. But as we move along, yes, like you said, it's of great symbolic value, but in practical terms, they don't have to sign the convention. And you know, a lot of people, even the UNHCR representative, will say that we would rather have proper policies and laws in place that protect them and give them real rights than to sign a convention and not have it implemented. Cambodia is a signatory to the convention. Philippines is a signatory to the convention. And it doesn't mean just because you sign the convention, it's going to be a pull factor necessarily.
Yeah, I almost feel that Malaysia works better with that kind of international pressure. I think this is how the way we work almost. Like, you know, just leaving ourselves to our own devices. I'm just not convinced. So I would like for
to
us
believe
to,
that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But it's also, I mean, look at the number of conventions, international human rights conventions Malaysia has
signed.
It's three. I mean, it's really one of the lowest in the region. In a region that already, you know, doesn't really subscribe to many human rights standards. So, yeah. Yes, it would be great if they sign it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that when they do sign it, you know, refugees in Malaysia are going to get those rights. it's still has to be implemented into law, and that can be a really long process. So we just, I think what's really important in terms of trying to get policies to move forward is really understanding what are the issues that the government sees as problematic and then trying to address those head on. Pull factor, what we'll do for our economy, national security, crime rates, you know, all of these are problems that certainly is spoken about but can be addressed if there's the political will to do so.
Yeah. It seems to be, we seem to be living in this era. I mean, it's not a third world war, but there still seems to be crazy mass migrations taking place because of the scale of wars that seem to be taking place around the world. That being said, both of you must have contact with a lot of people on the ground. So not just within the NGO community and not just within Putrajaya. And I'm always curious to know, in your conversations with the everyday Malaysian, what are their reactions to the ideas of refugees? I mean, we're happy to share a Facebook article about Rohingyas on boats, and we're happy to retweet something that Amnesty puts out there. Yeah. But how do we really feel when it comes to taking in refugees? You can be honest.
It's World Refugee Day.
It's World Refugee Day.
You can't. The least you can do is not lie on World Refugee Day.
You know, I mean,
name and shame.
Yeah. So, of course, this is my personal experience here. I mean, unfortunately, I think for a start, most Malaysians don't understand what a refugee is. Mm-hmm. Refugees. What's the difference between a refugee, a migrant worker, a trafficked person, a stateless person? What's the difference? Internally displaced person. I mean, you can go on and on, and those who work in this area, you know, we can rattle off the different conventions, the definitions and so on. It's first nature to us. But for most people out there, it's just another phrase. People get mixed up one with another. So for instance, what does make a big difference is when they can feel, they have a personal experience of what these people are going through. So when the Andaman Sea issue transpired, you know, everybody could very quickly imagine, my goodness, I'm stranded out in a boat in the Andaman Sea. Look, if the boat's sinking, I would like some help. Can we give them help? You know, we're not just saying we recognize your status, we're going to feed you forever, we're going to give you work. No, let's get them off the
sea. Save some lives.
Save some lives. No issue. Nobody's going to disagree with that. So get them on. And so people can very readily respond to that. But when it gets into nitty-gritty, and then, you know, generally the populace kind of doesn't really pay that much attention.
Well, that's interesting, because even in that Andaman Sea situation, you could see government officials from their respective countries almost trying to figure out their next move on Monopoly, on this board of, well, if we do this, then this happens. And they're thinking out loud with reporters with microphones in their face. And it's very interesting because you're right. The public really resonates with visuals and things that they can sort of relate to. Yeah. But the moment, let's say, they land, or the moment that they're saved, all right, I think we've done our part. Thank you very much.
And you can really see that from the lack of, you know, any sort of follow-up and in the lack of media articles about what happened to the ones that have been
after
rescued.
After those 2 weeks, I mean, we're partly to blame. We stopped talking about it after those 2 weeks as well.
We blame you.
No, thank you.
Are you going to edit that out?
No, never.
No, just to give a sense.
So coming back to that about resonating with the public, I mean, like the Syrian refugees, when the child's body washed up on the shores of Europe.
And that stark photo.
That's, I mean, horrendous. I mean, unfortunately, why does it have to get so bad before people take notice? Mm-hmm. But things changed, and there was a better response of that. We hope that doesn't have to happen here, but sometimes it does happen. We just don't know about it. We don't see it. We don't feel it. And then things don't change.
Do you get a different response given the people that you work with and mix around with? I'm assuming, Daniel, that you're speaking to a lot of policymakers all the time.
I mean, on both sides. For instance, when I think it was before Christmas last year, there were some riots or some alleged riots
Germany?
In Germany.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And then it was, you see?
It's because of the refugees.
Because of the refugees. And then close friends of mine would have said, you see, this is what you get when you bring these kinds of people to your country. Mm-hmm. And I thought, no. And I mean, what was very interesting is later on it was revealed that no, actually, it wasn't the refugees that were doing this at all. But it's so easy to stereotype and say that. And it's hard to speak directly to people's prejudices and you know, quick framing of these issues, because that's not the case.
But you don't even have to go as far as the refugees. Yeah. I mean, yeah. We react that way in Malaysia to anyone who isn't us.
Yes.
Yeah. I was dealing with a housing agent the other day, and he was telling me how Malaysians, it's becoming, you know, the property market's soft, it's becoming very hard to, and Malaysian owners are just basically going, yeah, I don't want any Middle Easterners, I don't want Africans, I don't want this, I don't want that. So we're already that, is it implicit or explicit racism? I don't know anymore. Well, we're already that.
We could say classist even.
So when it comes to refugees and migrant workers, and displaced people, I don't know how we'd react. And that's why I asked you that question, because honestly, I don't know how I would react as well. I'm all for saving lives. But where do you draw the line with the sheer numbers when they start coming in? And that's the problem that's happening in Australia. It's the problem that's happening in Europe right now.
I mean, I think Deepa can maybe speak more precisely. In terms of the numbers of refugees, we're talking about, let's say, in Southeast Asia, even Australia. When you compare to Europe, we've got nothing to compare with. You know, we're into the thousands, they're into the millions. So, hey, very, very different capacity issues that they're faced with.
All right, folks, it's World Refugee Day. In the studio with us is Deepa Nambiar, Director of Asylum Access Malaysia, as well as Daniel Lowe. He's a Special Officer of Human Rights to Senator Paul Lau of the Prime Minister's Office. More about why refugees in the region choose to seek refuge on our shores, it's after this on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, you're with Uma and Ezra, and it's World Refugee Day, and we're speaking to Deepa Nambiar. She's the Director of Asylum Access Malaysia. That's an international organization that works on protecting refugees through legal aid and policy advocacy, as well as Daniel Lowe, Special Officer of Human Rights to Senator Paul Lau at the Prime Minister's Office. Today we're speaking about the reasons why refugees seek refuge right here in Malaysia. We were mentioning about the pull factor, and when we compare to the different countries that are headed towards accepting different people from different countries, could you elaborate a little bit further on how that pull factor works, or exactly what is this pull factor?
I'm assuming Malaysia, being a predominantly Muslim nation, is also a pull factor for a lot of the refugees from the Middle East. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that is part of it. I think, Ezra, your question about what is really this pull factor, it is a theory of cause. I mean, one doesn't really know until you interview individuals who have come and says, really, what were the top three, four criteria which caused you to come to Malaysia? Okay, so it's a theory that we believe and factors which encourage individuals to come to our particular country. You know, do the Rohingya particularly come here for a particular reason? Well, we can go on about is it because we're a majority Muslim country? And is that why? I think one few things are very clearly proven to be pull factors. One above all is simply we are an economy that's doing very well. So heaven forbid we want to scuttle our own economy to shoo these refugees and make it a push factor. So I don't think that's really what. But really, that's one of the biggest factors which cause refugees to come to Malaysia. I mean, this is anecdotal discussions. Many of the refugees that went to Aceh kind of gravitate to Peninsula Malaysia because jobs are here. The economy is growing here. So that's really where people come to. Why not Sumatra as opposed to Peninsula Malaysia? Yeah. Well, that's really why.
Yeah, I mean, we've thought about this for a long time, and of course we speak to a lot of refugees, and it comes out, you know, kind of some of the reasons why they come to Malaysia, and Daniel has identified a few of the big ones. And yes, you know, sometimes people say it's a moderate Muslim nation, we have a lot of refugees from the Middle East, but 93% of the refugees in Malaysia are from Myanmar, and that I think speaks to where we are geographically as well.
It's proximity.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing that in Europe and in Syria. Of course, there's over 1 million refugees in Lebanon, in Turkey, so just porous borders, that's one of it. Also, we've got fairly lax visa, you know, immigration entry requirements. I mean, let's be honest. Like, a lot of refugees fly in from the Middle East. It's easy to get a 1 month, 3 month
visa tourist upon visa. Entry,
And then many of them just tend to overstay. And then the majority of Burmese refugees come through very porous borders. Many of them are smuggled in. You take boats through to Thailand and into Malaysia. Family reunification is another reason. Many of them already have family members or they know friends here, and so it's a popular destination. And of course, the economic factor is another really, really big one.
Speaking anecdotally, the other thing I heard is that Malaysia is a very popular pit stop en route to Australia. Is that true?
Well, I think that is definitely the case. The concern of the Australians, and they have been working with Indonesian and Malaysian government to minimize that. They continue to work on processes to minimize the boat arrivals in Australia. And again, they are antagonists, protagonists to their policies. But I think one of the admirable parts of their policy is just they don't want anybody on boats because boats sink and people die. So that's really what they... So they really made sure that they have layers of prevention efforts. One thing that I don't think many people know is that whilst we have a vast majority of the refugees in Malaysia are Rohingya, I think there's several hundreds of thousands of Rohingya in Bangladesh. So because they've just moved over the border that side. Mm-hmm. So geographical proximity is a big factor.
You know, I was watching, you know, this documentary, I think it was in 2014, it was produced by Al Jazeera, and it was really sort of, you know, portraying that the Malaysian government was being rather neglectful of the rights of refugees and asylum seekers. But these allegations, they were then denied by the Deputy Home Minister Wan Junaidi back then. He was quoted as saying that refugees in Malaysia were treated with dignity and were given access to medical treatment and visitation. So how do we actually reconcile some of these media portrayals against what's actually been happening on the ground of how we actually deal with refugees?
I think refugees as undocumented persons in Malaysia, they don't have a legal right to access medical education for children. However, they still do get served at public hospitals. The question is then of payment. And the question is of their own personal security. Will they be detained, arrested, and then at risk of deportation? And then the question is of those who are detained in immigration detention centres, how fast are they then recognised by UNHCR and then released under the undertaking of UNHCR? So those who have not been released then stay in detention, and then that's where the government faces criticisms because for anybody who's been to immigration detention centres, they are not meant to be long-term detention centres, unlike jails and prisons. So they are not constructed for that, and the conditions are pretty trying.
What's the situation with refugees that get exploited? I mean, the fact that there is no law means they're very prone to the kind of abuses that take place all the time with ruthless criminal type behavior and people. And oftentimes the refugees get punished themselves and not enough action is taken against the criminal elements involved in this situation. Is there any progress in trying to actually treat these individuals with dignity at the same time preventing this from happening?
Well, Umar, I think that the problem is access to justice. I mean, if you are an individual who has no legal status in a country, and then everything follows from that, right? I mean, we take it for granted because we have an IC. When we apply for a bank account, when we apply for a job, we have a driver's license, we have a place of residence. It goes on and on and on. We actually kind of forget how critical our legal status is. So when you don't have that, it kind of puts people at risk. So then the issue of access to justice becomes incredibly difficult. Now, that puts them in a high risk bracket. Yeah, I think that does happen. We hear lots of stories, and I think there was recently a case of a police officer extorting funds from some teenagers that was captured on a video. If it happens to teenagers, very often I hear that it also happens to undocumented individuals, including refugees.
Deepa, what do you guys do to help this situation?
Well, having UNHCR documentation helps. because the Malaysian government and law enforcement, they do respect it for the most part. Of course, you know, we hear sometimes negotiations have to take place. But that's a really important aspect of it, which is why we do what we do, really focusing on making sure that as many refugees get the UN documentation, which allows them that negotiation aspect. And also it gives them 50% discount at public hospitals for medical care. Sometimes employers also will hire people who have refugee cards as opposed to those who don't. And it puts you in the resettlement pipeline to be resettled to a third country. So that helps. But at the same time, you're right, it's a huge problem. Almost every single client of ours has been stopped by the police, has said it has to pay a bribe. It's a daily occurrence all over the place. And it's something that absolutely needs to be dealt with. But as Daniel correctly pointed out, there's no legal status for them. And so in terms of enforcing any of these rights, it makes it almost impossible. But just to also add on the flip side, I mean, the government also, I think we could do a lot more in terms of enforcing, for example, the Anti-Trafficking Persons Act. After the mass graves were found along the Thai-Malaysia border, there were a lot of action taken on the Thai side. But I think in Malaysia, only last week, four people were charged in connection with that. And I think in Thailand, something like 40 or 50, I forget the number, people were investigated and charged as well. So, I think we really need to up the game on in terms of enforcement of the laws that we do have. Because there's very little right now we can do in terms of giving refugees access to rights based on the documentation that they do have right now.
Yeah. So one thing that I know that UNHCR has been doing is increasing the integrity of the cards which they produce. They've put some fancy technology into it to make it not copyable and also verifiable. So with that increase of integrity, then the card itself isn't just a plastic card which anybody can just print and you know, say to any law enforcement that I am a UNHCR card holder, you have to let me go. From the perspective of law enforcement, I think they have a very difficult task. The genuine law, men and women in blue who do good, what's a UNHCR card to them if there's no law? So we go back to the issue of law and recognition. They say, look, unless you either have an IC or a valid a visa under our Immigration Act, I don't know what this is.
No, because I think it was in March of this year that there was that fake UNHCR
that's not
card
actually,
scandal.
Yeah, I know, but it's not a new thing. It percolates from time to time. It has come up. And therefore, UNHCR is addressing it as far as I've been in discussions with them, and they are addressing those issues. I do understand also that within our home ministry that there are discussions about how we will then be able to recognize those cards, or whether we will have the UNHCR database in our database, in the Malaysian government system. Because otherwise, how is our law enforcement supposed to recognize a card? I mean, it's just a piece of plastic if there's no law to provide that with legal basis.
Yeah. And the value of that cannot be overstated, because detention and arrest is one of the biggest problems, if not the biggest problems,
Some people, you only detained for 24 hours or 2 days. Well, besides the horror of that, I mean, if you have a job, you don't turn up for 2 days, you don't have a job.
And if your reason for not turning up is I was arrested in prison, still don't have a job.
You would have a job. And then if you have children, if you have people that are dependent upon you, that all falls apart as well very, very quickly. So, yeah.
So what can we do for them? What's next? I mean, so in the situation with the Syrian refugees, Putrajaya did promise education, shelter, jobs. I mean, Deepa, are there enough organizations now out there who heard that and went, wait, hold on. What about the other 150,000? What's going on? Do we get education? I suppose there needs to be pressure groups, lobby groups who are lobbying for the rest, right? Who maybe aren't as sexy, as popular because they aren't in the news every day.
Yeah. I think you really hit the nail on the head there. That's really one of the things that's really lacking in civil society. Refugee issues, I mean, apart from what happened last year, it was hardly ever spoken about. And, if there was anything good that came out of that incident, is that people started talking about it. And people, certain groups of people finally understood the difference between a refugee and a migrant, although, by and large, not necessarily everyone does. But yes, we there isn't enough lobby groups putting pressure, and there needs to be.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. Generally, I mean, so if the listeners out there are interested in supporting refugees and communicating their views to the government, write to our office, write to the Prime Minister's Department. If they want to support refugees, join DEEPA's organization, support, you know, refugees. If you're an employer out there and you have jobs that you want to make available, UNHCR actually has a livelihoods program unit. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, they can also communicate these views to the government. To demonstrate that really these people are human beings, and we just want to care for them just like everybody else.
After the break, we explore how public policy can help better the livelihood of refugees in Malaysia. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the Evening Edition. You're with Uma and Ezra. Today is World Refugee Day, and in the studio with us is Deepa Nambiar. She's the director of Asylum Access Malaysia, an international organization that works on protecting refugees through legal aid and policy advocacy. And Daniel Lowe, Special Officer of Human Rights to Senator Paul Lau at the Prime Minister's Office. Now, we've been speaking at length about the current refugee crisis in the country, and I guess when it comes to the solution, and if we're trying to think about that very sexy word, policy, you know, is there a model to follow from neighboring countries? Is there a successful policy that has been put in place to welcome and treat refugees? And how far away is Malaysia from that?
It's a tough one. Principally because, you know, we talk about policy, coherence of policy. We talk about durable solutions. See, the question is, where do these people come from and where would they really like to be? And I think, and I can quote Obama's words, he said, you know, I think they would like to live where they were born.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, really, can they go back there and can they live there? Now, if that political solution isn't solved or isn't addressed, then we don't really, it's not going to be a quick fix and easy solution. And unfortunately, not just Malaysia, but in every country, refugees becomes a political hot potato and it gets kicked around to political ends. So that also makes it quite difficult for genuine policymakers to make coherent policies for that and bear and weather the political wind and weather on that. So it's not going to be quick solution in a hurry.
Yeah, and just to sort of follow up on that, I think refugee policy has always been looked at as a temporary solution that's needed for a temporary problem. But if we look at what's happening, I think the average time a refugee spends in exile is around 18 years. And so if we look at it in those terms, then we can't be talking about temporary solutions. We can't be talking about, you know, let's find a shelter place for them to live and give them some food. It's an entire generation, yep. Absolutely. And with the state of wars, you know, voluntary repatriation or going back home is not an option. And every refugee will tell you, absolutely, they want to go back home. Resettlement to third countries, it's less than 1% of the refugee population gets resettled to a Western country. So we're talking about the vast majority of refugees being in host countries for a very, very long time. And I think once people understand it in those terms, and also very importantly, seeing how refugees can benefit host communities, that's the big conversation we need to start having.
Well, yeah, because that's what governments need to do, right? Thinking about it purely from a mercenary point of view, they will be incredibly active contributors to this economy as well. And so you should use them as you would use your own citizens and make them active contributors to the economy.
Yeah.
Well, I think one would definitely hoped, and well, I think the statistics are pretty clear that refugees actually do support the local economy. If nothing else, they actually drive demand. They demand services, housing, food. They create, I mean, they do jobs which other people are not so inclined to do.
Prepaid phone cards with data connections. Telling you, they sell like hot potatoes.
Yeah. I mean, there are certain telcos that really leverage on that kind of stuff.
Exactly. So I think there is a lot of rhetoric and misplaced patriotic feelings, which says, oh, you know, those people are coming to our country to take our stuff away. The economics doesn't bear that out. The statistics, you know, the decades of research doesn't bear that out at all. But that's not so easy to communicate. But, you know, I hope the listeners hear that and, you know, they change their views on that.
Now, just to wrap up, what steps can be done in the short term that when we speak to you in a year from now that we won't at least have to deal with anymore? Are there any small wins that we can look forward to?
Well, I think there are some pilot programs which I hope to be, I've heard of that will be kicking off. So I hope that there'll be some test programs and pilot programs which work out well. If they work out well, then that might open up for greater recognition. We are also not just considering ourselves, but there are other countries in the region. We do need to work together. It is a regional problem. It's a part of the larger ASEAN, you know, grouping. So it will hopefully teach us to talk to one another and work as friendly neighbors rather than burying our heads in the ground and hoping things just fix itself. But people do need to help. Do need the help of governments, because these are political problems. Without which governments, without government support and policy and aid, people will suffer.
Yeah. We've heard in the media quite a bit about the government wanting to implement some sort of work rights policy for refugees. They said it more recently in relation to the Rohingya refugees. But over the past few years, that has come up. So we know it's not completely off the table. And we are very hopeful. I mean, that's one of the impact of having refugees being able to work legally really extends to almost all other areas of their lives. Their children will be able to get access to medical care. What that means is they have documents, so they are legal and they won't be arrested. They have some sort of access to justice, hopefully, with that documentation that's recognized by the government. So that is, it may seem like something that's minor, but it really has huge implications. So that's one thing that we are very hopeful, at least, you know, at least in a pilot stage, it will show positive results, and then it will be able to expand to something broader. But also, we just from a rights-based perspective and from an NGO perspective, we're really hoping that people start talking about it a lot more. For me personally, it was when I met a refugee that I was really transformed, and I really understood that what their needs and their wants and their lives was exactly like mine, and that really made me want to get involved in this work more. And so that is what I'm hoping the Malaysian public will start doing, getting to know refugees who live in your communities. You know, there are kids selling flowers in Changkat Bukit Bintang. You know, they are working in construction. They live amongst us. Yeah. And so if we stop seeing them as separate from us, but as part of us and as real contributors to our society, I think there can be really big change, and really pushing our adults and our MPs and other people who are really in a position of influence to make those concrete stand on this issue.
Deepa, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today. Now, folks, if you've missed any part of this interview, you can download and listen to the podcast at bfm.my. It's been the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.